Welcome to the Man of God Network, a podcast ministry of Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary in Owensboro, Kentucky. This is the voice of the narrated Puritan, now in the 37th year of audio book and sermon narration ministry that can be found at puritanaudiobook.com or on Sermon Audio on a search for the narrated Puritan. The following is the story of the imprisonment of Adoniram Judson, missionary to the Burman Empire, 1824. There are two parts of this story. For the sights outside of the prison, in that detail, we have a letter from Ann Judson to Adoniram Judson's brother, Elnathan. From the details inside of the prison, it is a work called A Narrative of 2 Years Imprisonment in a Burman Prison by Henry Gouger of the East India Company that was published in the year 1860. Most of this story is going to be taken from Henry Gouger's account, but I want to give you the background information from the letter of Ann to Elnathan, May 26, 1826. My beloved brother, I commence this letter with the intention of giving you the particulars of our captivity and sufferings at Ava, how long my patience will allow my review and scenes of disgust and horror. The conclusion of this letter will determine. I'd kept a journal of everything that had transpired from our arrival at Ava, but destroyed it at the commencement of our difficulties. On the 8th of June, just as we were preparing for dinner, in rushed an officer holding a black book with a dozen Burmans, accompanied by one whom, from his spotted face, we knew to be an executioner and a son of the prison. "Where is the teacher?" was the first inquiry. Mr. Judson presented himself. "You are called by the king," said the officer, a form of speech always used when about to arrest a criminal. The spotted man instantly seized Mr. Judson, threw him on the floor, and produced a small cord, the instrument of torture. I caught hold of his arm. "Stay," I said. "I will give you money." "Take her, too," said the officer. "She also is a foreigner." Mr. Judson, with an imploring look, begged they would let me remain until further orders. The scene was now shocking beyond description. The whole neighborhood was collected. The masons at work on the brick house threw down their tools and ran. The little Burman children were screaming and crying. The Bengali servants stood in amazement at the indignities offered their master and the hardened executioner with a kind of hellish joy drew tight the cords, bound Mr. Judson fast, and dragged him off I knew not where. In vain I begged and entreated the spotted face to take the silver and loosen the ropes, but he spurned my offers and immediately departed. I gave the money, however, to Moon Ing to follow after to make some further attempt to mitigate the torture of Mr. Judson, but instead of succeeding, when a few rods from the house, the unfeeling wretches again threw their prisoner on the ground and drew the cord still tighter so as almost to prevent respiration. The officer and his gang proceeded on to the courthouse, where the governor of the city and officers were collected, one of whom read the order of the king to commit Mr. Judson to the death prison, into which he was soon hurled. The door closed, and Moon Ing saw no more. What a night was now before me! I retired into my room and endeavored to obtain consolation from committing my case to God, and imploring fortitude and strength to suffer whatever awaited me. But the consolation of retirement was not long allowed me, for the magistrate of the place had come into the verandah and continually called me to come out and submit to his examination. But previously to going out, I destroyed all my letters, journals, and writings of every kind, lest they should disclose the fact that we had correspondence in England, and had minuted down every occurrence since our arrival in the country. When this work of destruction was finished, I went out and submitted to the examination of the magistrate, who inquired very minutely of everything I knew, then ordered the gates of the compound to be shut, no person to be allowed to go in or out, placed a guard of 10 ruffians to whom he gave a strict charge to keep me safe, and departed. Now just a couple of paragraphs from Anne's first entrance into the death prison. Quote, "I then procured an order from the governor for my admittance into prison, but the sensations produced by meeting your brother in that wretched, horrid situation, and the affecting scene which ensued, I will not attempt to describe. Mr. Judson crawled to the door of the prison, for I was never allowed to enter, gave me some directions relative to his release. But before we could make any arrangement, I was ordered to depart by those iron-hearted jailers who could not endure to see us enjoy the poor consolation of meeting in that miserable place. In vain I pleaded the order from the governor for my admittance. They again harshly repeated, 'Depart, or we will pull you out.' The same evening, the missionaries, together with the other foreigners who paid an equal sum, were taken out of the common prison and confined in an open shed in the prison enclosure. Here I was allowed to send them food and mats to sleep on, but was not permitted to enter again for several days. And now for the story of the inner prison, we go to Henry Gouger's account. Henry Gouger. He worked for the East India Company, starting in the year 1822, and ended up in Rangoon, Burma. He was from England, and when England went to war with Burma, all those who spoke English were looked at as suspect. To make a long story short, he ended up in Ava and imprisoned with Adoniram Judson. This is the story of the imprisonment. For a biographical sketch of Adoniram Judson, please consult my biographies on him at sermonaudio.com. Before we begin this amazing narrative, a biographical paragraph shows the relation there was between Henry Gouger and Adoniram Judson. I sometimes spent my evenings at Dr. Judson's house, where they were present at the family devotions, which were held in the Burmese language, and it was impossible not to be struck with the reverence of demeanor, the propriety of language, and above all, the knowledge of the New Testament, and of saving doctrines which some of them manifested in their extempore prayer. No one who heard could doubt their sincerity. Now we move forward to the story of Gouger's time with Judson in a Burmese prison. My heart sank within me as I entered the gate of the prison yard, which, as it closed behind me, seemed to shut me out forever from all the interests and sympathies of the world beyond it. I was now delivered over to the wretches, seven or eight in number, who guarded this jail. They were all condemned malefactors whose lives had been spared on the condition of their becoming common executioners. The more hideous the crime for which he had to suffer, the more hardened the criminal, the fitter instrument he was presumed to be for the profession he was henceforth doomed to follow. If a spark of human feeling remained, it could hardly be expected that any of these men would voluntarily adhere to their calling of it, that is, Luthet, the murderer. On the principle that a soft imp gave rise to the name, they were commonly known by Pachat, or Ring-Cheeked, a term detested even by themselves as one of reproach, the one we never dared to apply in addressing them. The nature of its qualification for the employment was written in a similar manner across his breast. The chief of the gang was a lean, wiry, hard-featured old man, whose qualifications for his office stared in unusually large characters, as though he were out of it. Luthet, the murderer. On the principle that a soft answer turns away wrath, we taught ourselves to address this miscreant under the appellation Afa, father, as did all his subordinates. Another bearing an appropriate motto had murdered his brother and had hidden the body piecemeal under his house. This troop of wretches were held in such detestation that the law prohibited their entering any person's house except in execution of their office. It happened so soon after I entered that the exigencies of this brotherhood were great from an increase of business, and no brave malefactor in humanity was always styled bravery here. Being ready to strengthen the force, a young man convicted of a petty offense was selected to fill the vacancy. I beheld this poor youth doomed to the most abasing ignominy for the rest of his life by these fatal rings, his piteous cries at the degradation he was undergoing being drowned by the jeers and ridicule of the Confederates. They soon made him as much a child of the devil as themselves. Such were my jailers. It is not easy to give a correct idea of the scene which the interior of that prison house disclosed, as the door shut behind me and left me to survey it at leisure. Yet, as it was destined to be my dwelling place for the first year of my captivity, I must endeavor to describe it. Impossible as the task may be to convey by words what the eye alone can appreciate. Although it was between 4 and 5 o'clock on a bright sunny afternoon, the rays of light only penetrated through the chinks and cracks of the walls sufficiently to disclose the utter wretchedness of all within. Some time elapsed before I could clearly distinguish the objects by which I was surrounded. As my eyes gradually adapted themselves to the dim light, before me stretched on the floor lay 40 or 50 hapless wretches whose crimes or misfortunes had brought them into this place of torment. They were all nearly naked, and the half-famished features and skeleton frames of many of them too plainly told the story of their protracted sufferings. Very few were without chains, and some had one or both feet in the stocks besides. A sight of such squalid wretchedness can hardly be imagined. It had no window or aperture to admit light or air, except a closely woven bamboo wicket used as a door, and this was always kept closed. Fortunately, the builders had not expended much labor on the walls, the planks of which here and there were not very closely united, affording through the chinks the only ventilation the apartment possessed. If we except a hole near the roof, where, either by accident or design, nearly a foot in length of decayed plank had been torn off, this formed a safety valve for the escape of the foul air to a certain extent, and but for this fortuitous circumstance, it is difficult to see how life could have long been sustained. Before me, stretched on the floor, lay 40 or 50 hapless wretches, whose crimes or misfortunes had brought them into this place of torment. They were all nearly naked, and the half-famished features and skeleton frames of many of them too plainly told the story of their protracted sufferings. Very few were without chains, and some had one or both feet in the stocks besides. A sight of such squalid wretchedness can hardly be imagined. Silence seemed to be the order of the day. Perhaps the poor creatures were so engrossed with their own misery that they hardly cared to make many remarks on the intrusion of one so unusual as an inmate as myself. If the ensemble be difficult to portray, the stench was absolutely indescribable, for it was not like anything which exists elsewhere in creation. I will therefore give the facts and leave the reader's nose to understand them by a synthetic course of reasoning if I can. The prison had never been washed, nor even swept, since it was built. So I was told, and have no doubt it was true, for besides the ocular proof from its present condition, it is certain no attempt was made to cleanse it during my subsequent tenancy of 11 months. This gave a kind of fixedness or permanency to the fetid odors, until the very floors and walls were saturated with them and joined in emitting the pest. Putrid remains of castaway animal and vegetable stuff, which needed no broom to make it to move on, the stale fumes from thousands of tobacco pipes, the scattered ejections of the pulp and liquid from their everlasting betel, and other nameless abominations still more disgusting which strewed the floor, and if to this be added the exudation from the bodies of a crowd of never-washed converts, encouraged by the thermometer at 100 degrees, in a den almost without ventilation, is it possible to say what it smelt like? As might have been expected from such a state of things, the place was teeming with creeping vermin, to an extent that very soon reconciled me to the plunder of the greater portion of my dress. I have done my best to give a faithful picture of the Burmese Letmeyun on first impressions, but this is merely superficial. Its hidden secrets had yet to be learned. Much time was not given me on entering to make these observations, for a young savage, himself a felon in chains, who had entrusted to him the safekeeping of his fellow prisoners, came shuffling up to conduct me to the darkest and most loathsome corner of the dungeon. Here I was sorry to find my fellow countryman, Mr. Layard, who had already gone through the same process as myself, and now lay weltering in the filthy sty allotted to him. I attempted to speak to him, but the first words had scarcely escaped my lips when the young savage, brandishing a formidable club, gave me to understand that he had received strict orders from our worthy father to brain any foreigner who attempted to speak in less than the Burmese language. This put a stop to our conversation, as poor Laird did not understand a word of Burmese. Stretched on the floor by the side of my countrymen, I waited to see what was to happen next. A short time brought Mr. Rogers, already known to the reader. All the precautions his timidity suggested had been unavailable to shield him from suspicion, and his hope of safety from naturalization was as nothing when contrasted with his rebel origin. It was melancholy to see the poor old man, bending with age, tottering to join our company. All the Englishmen were now collected. We three were the only true rebels in blood, and we had reason to hope, as no others had yet appeared, that our friends the Americans had made good their defense and would escape the general destruction. We soon perceived our mistake. Dr. Judson was next brought in. We had scarcely seen each other since a memorable Sunday when we were dispersed like a flock of sheep at Sagaing by the news of the fatal invasion. Useless were all the politic and cautious steps they took to avoid suspicion. In vain did they plead their sacred profession as teachers of religion. In vain that they were the subjects of a separate state, often at war with the English. They spoke our language. They were supplied with money by the English spy. They had been his intimate friends. That was enough. As to their sacred character, it probably told against them, seeing they had been making unconcealed attempts to subvert the Buddhist faith. We all suffered the same treatment, though it is probable we were not all in the same danger of our lives. From one of Mrs. Judson's letters written after the war, Dr. Judson's arrest appears to have been attended even with greater barbarity than my own. One cannot read it without a feeling of sympathy in the sufferings of a lady of refined and amiable manners. Dr. Judson had just taken his place by our side when the tall, gaunt figure of Dr. Price came into view. Unable at first to distinguish our disconsolate group through the gloom and the smoke, we watched him as he entered with an air of bewilderment and a soliloquy which, at any other time, would have made us all laugh, but it was quickly interrupted by a flourish of the club of the young savage. Price seemed at first inclined to show fight, like a true freeborn Yankee, it being thus arbitrarily deprived of the liberty of speech and the relief of uttering his lamentations aloud. But the upraised arm of power satisfied him that he had better quietly succumb to his fate. He was quite subdued when at length he beheld his silent friends, by whose side he took his place. When night came on, the father of the establishment, entering, stalked towards our corner. The meaning of the bamboo pole now became apparent. It was passed between the legs of each individual, and when it had threaded our number, seven in all, a man at each end hoisted it up by the blocks to a height which allowed our shoulders to rest on the ground, while our feet were suspended from the iron rings of the fetters. The adjustment of the height was left to the judgment of our kind-hearted parent, who stood by to see that it was not high enough to endanger life, nor low enough to exempt from pain. What a night was that on which we now entered, that first night. Death in its most appalling form, perhaps attended with the agony of unknown tortures, was thought by all to be our certain lot. Kawetni, who occupied the next place on the bamboo, excited a horrible interest by relating of a variety of exquisite tortures which he had known to be perpetrated under that roof. It chilled us to the heart to think on them, but the very abjects around us confirmed their truth by giving utterance to their opinions on our case, though too well understood by those they chiefly concerned. But all sank into insignificance before the awful thought that soon, perhaps in a few hours, all affinity with this world's cares and troubles would cease, and we would be summoned into eternity. I must make my honest confession that it was then that I felt the force and value of those sacred truths which I had so often heard but so little regarded. A thoughtless, careless life absorbed in the pursuits of this world, to the utter neglect of a future one, is a sad position from which to contemplate the sudden change to eternity. Felt it to be truly so. No one can enter completely into the thoughts and feelings and imagination of a person in this fearful position. It is useless to attempt to describe them, for words cannot convey an idea of the intensity of the struggle between doubt and hope and fear, which by turns flit across the unprepared soul in the prospect of its immediate change. For a long time I lay, as Jeremy Taylor quaintly expresses it, like a fox caught in a trap, aware of my danger and racking my imagination for the means to break through it. But the more I thought, the more confused and misty my thoughts became. Regrets in parting with the world hardly found a place. The gloom of the prison and the mass of misery strewed about it, brought dimly into view by the melancholy light of the single lamp, were in harmony with the diseased tone of my mind, and led me to acknowledge that this is not a world one ought to grieve at parting with. Just look on the scene before me and think of what the coming day will disclose, and then judge. No. It was not the giving up of this world, for I felt in my irritable mood it was not worth keeping, but the doubt of attaining the future one in safety, the leap in the dark, was the alarming thought. The sufferings of the body, severe as they were, disappeared before the all-important question, which was worse to endure than the fetters of the monarch or the sword of the executioner. I could reason myself without much difficulty into contempt of bodily pain, were I but satisfied with my title as it stood to future happiness. It is probable that a large majority of my fellow creatures, even of my own faith, would undergo similar perplexities and misgivings if suddenly hurried into a like state of peril. Our religion, intended to fortify us against the terrors of death, must be woefully misused when it becomes a means of exciting alarms, which even the heathen do not feel to the same extent. The deficiency does not lie in our creed, but in our habitual neglect of its provisions, as I could not but acknowledge and lament in this my hour of trials. After some hours of painful confusion of intellect, my mind became more calm. The hope which our faith alone holds out to sustain those who sincerely believe its sacred truths dawned on my mind. On the evening of the third day of our incarceration, we were removed to the more comfortable shed I have alluded to. Here we were allowed to remain 3 or 4 days without further molestation than that described, waiting in torturous suspense the first news of the war from Rangoon. As so many days had rolled on and our lives were still preserved, it was clear we had passed through one crisis in safety, the one we had most dreaded, and that our fate now depended on the course of events that might take place at Rangoon. We knew better than our tormentors what that course must be when civilized man was matched against the barbarian. Discipline and steady bravery against a tumultuary army, and a fitful ebullition of savage fury. What we now feared was the anger of the king on the overthrow of all of his sanguine hopes of conquest. We could but wait the result in patience, and encourage ourselves in the protection of the Almighty. Many weeks passed over our heads before the signal gun announced fresh news. The first reverse they had experienced, though insignificant in itself, had taught our enemies that they had a more difficult task than was at first expected, and that they did not hazard another attack until a larger force was concentrated before Rangoon. In the meantime, we were settling down into the habits of the prison, and were becoming familiar with such scenes as I have recounted about, while in the other the skill and sympathies of man are exerted to avert it. In many respects, death, when contemplated from the gloom of a dungeon, should be more desirable and welcome than when viewed from a bed of sickness, surrounded by sympathizing friends. Yet contrary to this admission, it is always most dreaded when our reason tells us it ought to be most welcome. In the meantime, we were settling down into the habits of the prison, and were becoming familiar with such scenes as I have recounted. We began also to speculate on the length of time nature could hold out, if we were left to test it. How long could we live in such plight without the use of water or other means of cleanliness? Would habit reconcile us to it, as it apparently had done to many of our fellow prisoners? Some of them had lived there for years. We gradually became acquainted with them and with their crimes, real or imputed. There were many cases in the calendar that were almost incredible and showed that accident, caprice, superstition, and even carelessness occasioned their confinement. One grimy, half-starved old man had been kept there for 3 years, and neither knew why he was there nor who had sent him. Our young friend with the club was an old inhabitant and was probably kept there because he could be entrusted as a guardian of the night, a good watchdog. Crime of another must have been that of a madman, or more probably it was a false accusation preferred to gratify private revenge. He was said to have made an image of the king and to have walked over it. The mere imputation of practicing necromancy against the sacred person of the king was a fatal charge. The poor fellow was taken from among us at the hour of midnight, and dispatched by breaking his spine. Why this singular method of slaughter was resorted to, as well as the manner of carrying it into execution, was as mysterious as the crime itself, but they were not at all particular as to the mode of depriving their victims of life, but seemed to be guided altogether by caprice. It is not improbable that we should have sunk under the intense heats of the month of June, in such a place and under such circumstances as I have described, had not our guardian angel, Mrs. Ann Judson, again contrived to soften the heart of the governor, when his anger at being compelled to restore our bribes had a little subsided. The plan I have given of the prison yard shows that on two sides there was a number of small cells, used for many purposes by the Ringed Brotherhood, and a pleading of our amiable protectors secured for us the liberty to occupy them. It is true they were very small, the one I inhabited being about 5 foot wide, with just enough length to lie down in. It was also so low that I could not stand upright except in the middle, where the roof was highest, but it was an elysium when compared with the suffocating choke of the inner prison, nor could it be called altogether solitary confinement, for one of our jailers had a pretty daughter about 16 years old who took a wonderful fancy to me and was a frequent visitor in my cell. She supplied me also with an unspeakable luxury, water, for ablution. Oh, who can appreciate the gift but those who have long been deprived of it? A scrap of rag moistened with some of the water given us to drink only served to smear the grime like a plaster over our bodies. Now once again I could call myself comparatively clean. My little cell had other advantages. My eyes escaped many scenes of revolting cruelty. My ears many foul anathemas and gross abuse. My lungs and olfactories all sorts of abominations. It abutted also on the main street, and through the chinks I could amuse myself by watching the passers-by. The chief loss was the society of my friends. The rats, too, were numerous and troublesome at first, but these, though a disgusting nuisance, I managed to turn to account by the fancy of the Paquettes for their flesh. The Burmese hold rats in about the same estimation as we do rabbits, and sell them commonly in their markets for about their own weight in lead. My cell, therefore, might be regarded as a well-stocked preserve for game. The burrows ran in all directions, and hardly a day passed without my bagging a few heads of this novel kind of game, and handing them over to my pretty visitor's father, who willingly lent me his spear for the purpose of destroying them. The bait of a few grains of boiled rice at the entrance of the burrows brought them out in shoals, and gave me the opportunity of spearing them. "What do you expect will be your fate?" said this pious Buddhist, as he once took the struggling vermin from the spear. "When the time comes for me to serve you as you are serving that creature, they all look forward to the pleasure of decapitating us, and when in a mild humor would promise me as a favor to use their greatest skill so that I could scarcely feel it. What a consoling thought!" Shut up close in my little cell, I thought that, at all events, my feelings would no longer be harrowed with the sights of deeds of blood. To a certain extent it was so, but even here there was no abiding peace and quietness. One night, as I was vainly endeavoring to coax myself asleep, the screams of an unfortunate wretch in the inner prison fell upon my ear, and the door of my cell being at the time unfastened, and the prison wall not more than 3 feet off, curiosity prompted me to peep through a crack to see what fresh mischief was on foot. Never shall I forget the foul assassination I witnessed. The inmates were breathlessly silent, evidently expecting some evil. The cries proceeded from a young man who lay stretched on the floor with his feet in the stocks. The lamp was burning dimly, giving just enough light to show the form of a grim Paquette striding towards his victim. Without a word, he stamped several times on the mouth of the youth with his heavy wooden shoes with a force which must have broken his teeth and jaws into fragments. From my hiding place, where I stood trembling with terror, I heard the bones crack and crash. Still the cries were not altogether silenced when the monster seized a club of the savage and with repeated blows on the body and head pounded the poor sufferer to death. One would think from the course of events which I have endeavored to describe that it was not easy to add to the weight of our troubles, nor from the circumscribed intercourse which it was possible for us to hold with the outer world, did there seem much reason to fear that any fresh crime could be imputed to us. I have before remarked, however, that there is no lot which man has to sustain in this life so wretched that it is incapable of becoming worse. In our discontented imaginations, we may think we have reached the bottom of the pit, and be disposed to defy fate to make us more completely miserable, but in this we are mistaken. Some unlooked for mischance sends us still lower, and shows us that no line can sound the depths of the calamities to which human life is liable. After I had been 2 months in the Lek Mai Yun, a misfortune happened which left me still more destitute, and at the same time, the reader will stare with astonishment, well nigh cost me my life for the crime of arson. Did I then, in a fit of despair, set fire to the prison, he will ask, and try to make an end of all of our miserable lives in one general conflagration? Not much to be wondered at if I did, but no such thing. One morning about 10 o'clock, while I was seated in my cell, hungry and wondering what could have prevented my man from bringing a daily bundle of boiled rice, as usual, a cry of fire arose in the street, and people were running in great excitement to the quarter whence the danger proceeded. In a city built of combustible materials like Ava, a fire is a terrible thing to contemplate. A division of the spotted men rushed away with the crowd like so many vultures to their prey, exulting in the hope that some of their craft would be in request. Nor were they mistaken in their conjecture. After a short time they returned, bringing with them as a prisoner, to my consternation, the very man who ought to have brought me my breakfast, one of my Bengali servants. The whole affair was now plain enough without further explanation. He had accidentally set the house on fire while boiling my rice and was paying a penalty of his carelessness. The fellow could have turned pale with fright, for a Bengali can turn pale, had not his countenance been liberally smeared with charcoal by the spotted men when they took him into custody. While round his neck they had suspended a firebrand to indicate his crime. His hands were bound behind him, and in this guise he was turned into the inner prison, there to wait until the morrow when the usual punishment of flogging round the town would be administered. We will end this episode by quoting from Adoniram Judson himself. I was seized on the 8th of June, 1824, in consequence of the war with Bengal, and in company with Dr. Price. Three Englishmen, one American, and one Greek, were thrown into the death prison at Ava, where we lay 11 months. 9 months in 3 pairs and 2 months in 5 pairs of fetters. The scenes we witnessed and the sufferings we underwent during that period I would fain consign to oblivion. From the death prison at Ava, we were removed to a country prison at Unpin Law, 10 miles distant, under circumstances of such severe treatment that one of our number, the Greek, expired on the road, and some of the rest, among whom was myself, were scarcely able to move for several days. It was the intention of the government in removing us from Ava to have a sacrifice in order to ensure victory over the foreigners, but the sudden disgrace and death of the advisor of that measure prevented its execution. I remained in the Unlitpin Law prison 6 months in 1 pair of fetters, at the expiration of which period I was taken out of irons and sent under a strict guard to the Burmese headquarters at Malawan to act as interpreter and translator. 2 months more elapsed when, on my return to Ava, I was released at the instance of Mung Swalu, the north governor of the palace, and put under his charge. During the 6 weeks that I resided with him, the affairs of the government became desperate, the British troops making steady advances on the capital, and after Dr. Price had been twice dispatched to negotiate for peace, a business which I declined as long as possible, I was taken by force and associated with him. We found the British above Pagan, and on returning to Ava with their final terms, I had the happiness of procuring the release of the very last of my fellow prisoners, and on the 21st instant, obtained the reluctant consent of the government to my final departure from Ava with Mrs. Judson.